This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is Percy Heath, one of the leading bassists in jazz. Percy Heath was a founding member of the Modern Jazz Quartet, one of the first groups to combine jazz improvisation with written classical forms and to play in concert halls instead of jazz clubs. This is the Modern Jazz Quartet performing Concord, written by the group's music director, pianist John Lewis, with Milt Jackson on vibes, Connie Kay drums, and Percy Heath bass, recorded in 1955. The Modern Jazz Quartet, which has played together since 1952 with only one personnel change, holds a record for longevity unsurpassed in jazz. The quartet broke up in 1975. Before they reunited in 1981, Percy teamed up to perform and record with his younger brothers, saxophonist Jimmy Heath and drummer Albert Tootie Heath. The Heath brothers make up one of contemporary jazz's most illustrious families. When they were growing up in South Philadelphia, their house was a hangout and practice studio for both local musicians and the big names who came to town to play the Philadelphia clubs. Percy started playing bass at 22, several years after he gave up the violin, the instrument he studied as a child. He told me how much he hated his early violin lessons.
I had a private teacher who used to rap me on the knuckles with the longest pencil I ever saw. My violin had stains from the rosin and tears. I used to hate that guy. Professor Pugsley was his name. I think he ended up really going out on the deep end. He used to write music on his cuffs of his sleeves. So that was my early teacher.
What kind of music was he teaching you?
Oh, little minuets and normal little violin pieces for, I used to play at teas, some little pop songs maybe. And
is that what you wanted to be playing, minuets?
No, that's what you played. It was to learn the violin, you played those little pieces that were written for amateur, well, for students.
Do you have good memories about growing up in Philadelphia?
Well, Philadelphia was always a rough place, and especially South Philadelphia. It wasn't exactly a bed of roses down there. It was a ghetto. And my early memories of when I was growing up was that the fact that they were, the neighborhood was mixed. There were at least three Italian families in the block I lived on, right across the street from a black public school. And although we played together in the afternoons and after, before and after school, the Italian and Jewish kids had to walk five or six blocks to another school. And it didn't dawn on me at the time that this was institutionalized segregation, which would haunt you the rest of your life. You know, we used to tease them saying, when the snow would be coming down, say, you got to walk six blocks. Yeah, you know. And we had to go right across the street to an all-black public school. And after I left there in the sixth grade, and we were put together in Barrett Junior High School, by then we were 12, 13 years old, and expected us to get along with the white kids. And I don't know if they really expected us to. It's like a divide and conquer, set it up from the word go. And that's my memory of Philadelphia. It's pretty bitter because it took me a long time to realize what they had done to us, you know. And I don't think it's really changed that much since then, you know. And that's 50 years, I'm talking about 55 years.
You were, I think, drafted into the military during World War II. And if I'm not mistaken, you were one of the first black fighter pilots.
I wasn't one of the first. I was one of the 500 that got their wings and were commissioned from Tuskegee. It was then the Tuskegee Army Air Force, which was also segregated. And ironically, when I was about 18 years old and registered for the draft, I went down to the courthouse there on Chestnut Street. I was an automobile mechanic at that time, working with my father, who was a very good mechanic, too. And I decided with this mechanical knowledge that I was going to go down and volunteer to become an aircraft mechanic. And I went through all this physical and booga-booga and examinations and everything and specified what I'd like to be and whatnot. And this at the end of the interview, this guy stamped 4F on my papers there, and he says, you don't weigh enough. I was really a frail, small person with a violin. You know, I had a rough time getting through school like that, too, and named Percy on top of that. But anyhow, instead of this sergeant telling me, look, we don't have any place to send a black man in this segregated Air Force to become a mechanic. Instead of him telling me that, he told me I was underweight and I was rejected for that reason. So I went back home and told Mama, well, I don't have to worry about getting drafted, Mama. I'm too skinny, and they rejected me. And about a year and a half later, my number came up, and I went through the same physical. And I told the guy, I said, Mama, I said, well, I'll be right back. I'm just going down here, formality, you know. They're not going to take me. And this guy stamped 1A on my papers. I said, wait a minute, what happened? He says, oh, don't worry, we'll fatten you up. And this was being drafted into the regular Army, which was mainly serving in supplies or something like that. And they had one tank division that was black, and not very many of the combat groups were black. Later they got some paratroopers and whatnot. But all of a sudden, in that interim, some congressman had spoken up or something and said, why are there no black pilots? And so for tokenism, they gave us the school in Tuskegee. In the meantime, I made a score that actually qualified me to become a pilot, bombardier, or navigator, as they told me, they asked me at the interview. So anyhow, I made it, and ironically, instead of a mechanic, I was a fighter pilot.
So you came back from World War II as a second lieutenant and fighter pilot. Did that give you any new ideas of what you wanted to do professionally?
It made up my mind for me, Terry, that after being an officer and a gentleman and flying airplanes around and having that status, that I didn't want to be an automobile mechanic again. So that's when I had to decide to go back to music.
When did you start playing bass? It wasn't until after you got
that
back from the war, right?
Yeah, 1946.
Why the bass? Why did you try bass?
Well, I couldn't play a little fiddle very well. So it was a 10-year interim, and I didn't play anything. And I decided, since I'd grown a little bit, that I was big enough to play the bass then, which I'd always admired in the school orchestra. And that's it. That's what I chose.
And you knew you wanted to play jazz?
Oh, I know nothing but jazz. That's all I know about.
When you started playing bass, your brother Jimmy, who was, I think, 2 years younger than you, was, I believe, already playing professionally. Did you envy him at all that here he was, like, your younger brother, and he was already making a living as a musician?
Not really. I was the older brother, and I had accomplished that Air Force thing, which was really a source of pride in the black community, that some were made officers and allowed to serve in that way. And Jimmy had started playing saxophone in Williston High School band before I even graduated. So there was no animosity between us about what profession he was in. He was on the road with a band called Nat Tolls in the Midwest, dance band. And when he heard that I was coming home and going to choose an instrument, he quit the band and came home because he had, at that time, heard Charlie Parker and the bebop music. And it wasn't what he was playing then, and he wanted to come home and learn about that. So somebody gave us an upright piano, and we rented a horse and wagon and carted it around the Federal Street. And that was the workshop. That was the crucible for all of the Heath brothers, right in that house on Federal Street.
Which is where you were
That's
living.
Where we lived at that time.
You became the house bassist at the Downbeat Club in Philadelphia. Was that a good experience for you, having to play? Probably, I imagine, a lot of the well-known performers coming in, jammed with the house band. Did that give you a chance to play with a lot of different kinds of musicians?
It certainly did, and I was really not prepared. You know, I had been playing a year and a half or something like that when I got that job. And I started out, actually, right away professionally, almost. It's amazing that when you look back that I've been playing professionally now since 46 is when I bought the bass. And to bring the point out, I wasn't proficient enough at the time Jimmy had his big band around town to even think of playing that music with them.
While you were playing at the Downbeat, your home, I think, became a gathering place for musicians from town and for visiting musicians, too.
It became that, and it was, like I say, with the drums later when Tootie started playing. It was set up in the living room. It was always a jam session of some kind, and then there was always record listening in the basement. We had the basement fixed up so we could do it later at night, you know, and tune into Symphony Sid and programs like that from New York. But Jimmy's band members used to come down and rehearse at the house, and
did your parents mind, or did the neighbors complain?
My mother, the greatest lady that ever lived. She, you know, later on it became, you'd wake up after being up late at night. We'd wake up a little later, 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. My mother would be down there playing Charlie Parker, doing her housework, you know. It was really beautiful. She enjoyed that music, and they were very proud of our achievements in that field because being involved with music and seeing us develop like that and become known.
When you moved to New York, you played with a lot of the top musicians. You played with Charlie Parker, for instance, and I'm sure he had been one of the inspirations for you. Was it hard when you were actually playing with him in the band together to was he still like a hero or a model to you? Were you awed by him at all?
Of course. And, you know, to play with Charlie Parker, you really felt useless. You just hoped that you wouldn't do something to mess up what was happening. Your job was just to stay out of the way.
Let me ask you a little bit about playing with Thelonious Monk. Did he point you in any different directions playing with him, since his playing was so idiosyncratic?
Monk's music, to me, required me to do exactly what I knew at the time, which was to play fundamental bass notes and indicate each progression as was laid out in the chord changes. So to play with Monk was a joy because my note became really the foundation of his harmonic inferences. And so to play with Monk was beautiful with me. And the fact to play with all those guys, I was going to school, Terry, the whole 10 years of my first association with almost everybody in the jazz bebop era at that time.
My guest is bass player Percy Heath. Let's talk about how you got involved with the Modern Jazz Quartet. Now, most of the people in that group had been playing with Dizzy Gillespie, and they were in the rhythm section. And the rhythm section was featured as a separate part in the band.
Well,
can you describe that and how you became part of it?
That's the band that I used to go stand in front of in 46, 45, late 45, 46, when I first came home. Ray Brown was in that band. And
this is the Gillespie
Jackson,
band you're talking
the
about.
The big band of Dizzy at that time. But Dizzy broke up the big band after 49 or something, and I went with the sextet, which he had on the road at that time, which included Milt Jackson again. And then we started playing together as Milt Jackson's quartet with John Lewis, Kenny Clark, myself, and Milt. It was actually his quartet up until John decided that he had an idea of a direction for a quartet of that instrumentation, and that he wasn't interested in writing those compositions for somebody else's group, like Milt Jackson Quartet. So we were told to try to think of a name that didn't have anybody's name in it.
The Modern Jazz Quartet didn't want to play clubs and played concert halls instead, and also frequently dressed in informal attire and in tuxedos. What was the rationale for that?
Well, not that we didn't want to play in nightclubs. We felt that jazz shouldn't be limited to nightclub appearances. Why should it always be still in brothels and nightclubs, smoky nightclubs? Why not concert stage? Benny Goodman, bless his soul, had already had it in Carnegie Hall. Now, gee, why not in the concert halls? It's a listening music. Why not? It wasn't always just to dance by.
When you tried and succeeded in playing concert halls instead of clubs and in dressing in formal attire, was everyone in the group in agreement on that? Did you want to do that?
Why not? I had been getting dressed up all my life. I've got pictures of me. I go back now and people say, don't you ever get tired of wearing a tie? No, when I get dressed up, since I was 10 years old, I put on a tie. I got pictures of me, you know, with knickers on with a tie. So what is a tie? What does that mean? Why should you be in your shirt sleeves if you're a performer on a stage? Well, you know, when I was growing up in Philadelphia, our source of pride was the black bands. And every week I heard every band that came through Philadelphia. I met Fats Waller, you know, and Louis Armstrong.
I met them all,
and every time they stepped out on the stage, they were sharp, baby. And that pride of a performer in jazz music, to be clean, to be sharp, not to look like a member of the orchestra, of the audience, that was, I can't get away from it, that's all.
The Modern Jazz Quartet combined some classical style and jazz, and was, you know, really known as one of like the first third stream type groups. Yeah, you're gonna say something.
No, it's okay, Terry. Finish it. I know what you're saying, but you know, these labels and
well, I guess what I was gonna ask you though. Yeah,
and stuff
I was gonna
like
ask
that.
You if you had to change your technique. Did you have to change your technique?
I didn't have
any
technique. I was going to school then every day. Every chart that John Lewis wrote for me was a challenge for me to learn how to do it and say what it was supposed to say and do my, what was relegated as my responsibility as far as harmonic purity and get the best sound you can get and the intonation and on time and play your passage and speak up when you're supposed to and back up when you're not supposed to be, you know what I mean? This was all integrated in the writing of the music. How it should sound was left up to the musical director, and poor little Purse was just trying to do it. You know what I mean? The best I could. And that challenge would come, and as soon as I would accomplish something like Concord, which was a very difficult piece of music for me at that time to even attempt with my limited study and whatnot. But I did it, and I've heard some records later where it had gotten so fast, I don't believe I played it. You know what I mean? And some of those older records, eventually what they evolved to after playing them 5 or 6 years, it's amazing, some of those recordings. I don't believe I did it, really, Terry, at that stage of my development. But as soon as I would accomplish that, up jumps another chart that was a little different and a little more challenging. Say, okay, you learned that, good. Now learn this.
You were on the road maybe 10 out of 12 months a year for a long time.
For a while there, we were gone.
How do you keep together a home life? Because you had a family, too, when you're on the road that much.
I was married to, and still I'm married to, a wonderful lady from Philadelphia, and June is her name. And she wanted to be my wife. She wanted to have our children, and she wanted to be their mother. And she wanted to have that home for me to come back to off the road. She wanted me to give this music to the world. And that's her contribution to it, too, because we have three sons grown, and all through her doing, I wasn't there. When I'd come home, it'd be like Christmas for a couple of months or a week or 10 days, and then I'm gone again. And June did it all alone, and I love her for that. And her, our boys, Percy is 35 now. Jason is 31, and the baby is 25. And they're all doing what they want to do. They're not involved in music, but they can play. A couple of them can play.
In 1974, after staying together for so long, since about 1952, the Modern Jazz Quartet split up. What were the reasons for the breakup, and did you want to split
up? No, I had put all my eggs in one basket. I was really crushed to think that I had to start after those 22 years to look for a job and figure out what to do. Of course, it dawned on me later that, hey, man, you've been wanting to play with your brothers all along, so here's your chance. But it was financial. We had been acclaimed as the world's greatest small group or the finest small group in jazz and this prestige, and we had been in some of the finest concert halls of Europe and America, and we just weren't making enough money. And I'll put that in another context. Some of us weren't making enough money. It was enough for me. We had worked it out institutionally as a corporation wherein we only paid each other a certain salary weekly, and we got that salary whether we worked or not. We had figured out to put it aside when we were working and collect when we weren't working. So we had worked up to, $500 or $600 a week, I don't know, something like that, every week. And that was enough for Percy. But Milt at the time thought he could make more money as a, you know, and he really was embittered by not making as much money being Milt Jackson and having won everything, every award for 15, 20 years or more. And still not reaping a financial benefit that he thought he should have.
Did you try to talk him out of it?
We did the best we could.
When the Modern Jazz Quartet split up, was it understood that you were going to play with your brothers, or did you have to talk it over and see if it was something you really wanted to do together?
No. They more or less had, was hoping that I would be available because, you know, we got together for recordings on occasion. But most of my time with the quartet, like you say, was taken up with the quartet. So we didn't have that opportunity, and each of us was pursuing his own individual career. But in the back of our mind, it was always, I know Pop would have loved it, but they had died a few years before this, and our parents had died, but they would have loved to see the brothers performing together.
There was a lot of pressure on the Modern Jazz Quartet to get back together. Their fans and critics really interested in you reuniting, and you did a couple of times, but it didn't last past the concert date, I guess. But a few years ago, the Modern Jazz Quartet reunited, and you're still, I believe, playing together, a few months out of the year?
Quite a bit. We're now back with our old management, Monty Kay, who was our manager for the first 22 years. And we should have a couple of good years of good, solid MJQ touring.
Why did you get back together again?
Why? The same reason you said. Everywhere we'd go individually, people always say, oh, why did you guys do that? You know, why did you destroy what was what people had grown up from their college days with, and they were now business people and whatnot, and they would come up and say, gee, is there any chance of you guys doing? So eventually there was a request from a radio station in Japan, Tokyo Broadcasting System, had their anniversary, and John and I had done a concert in Tokyo and in Japan, a few things, as the Monterey Jazz Festival in Tokyo, and it was presented as that and televised and whatnot. And they asked that we got the quartet back together as a sort of commemorative program for their anniversary, and we did.
How do you see the role of the bass in a quartet?
My idol, among my idols, is the father of all the bass players in modern, the concept, Jimmy Blanton, who turned everything around in 1939 and 1940 with the Duke Ellington organization. So my concept of a bass player in a group is to serve as a pulse and to imply harmonically what the progressions are in the song. I've never put too much emphasis on the soloing aspect of the bass, but I've always felt that my place was at home, at the bottom of things.
One last question. I wonder if your life now is pretty well in the kind of place you'd like it. You have the Modern Jazz Quartet a few months a year. You still play with your brothers as the Heath Brothers. And I think you probably have more time to be at home now than you used to.
You know, I'm 63 now, so I'm not thinking of doing this forever and ever like Milt Hinton. Boy, he's 75, and he told a kid recently, a kid offered to carry his bass for him. He says, no, he says, when I can't carry it, I'm going to quit playing it. But he's walking around 75 years old with a bass on his arm, you know, so I'm not that tough, I don't think. And I'd really like to just relax and do my other love. I like to fish a lot, which I do all summer when I can. 2 or 3 years, I'm leaning toward that. But naturally, I don't have the financial security to do that at this time. But we're working toward that.
That was bassist Percy Heath, a founding member of the Modern Jazz Quartet. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by associate producer Amy Sallet. Danny Miller and I produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible in part with funds provided by Philadelphia-based Cigna Corporation, a provider of insurance and related financial services to businesses and individuals worldwide. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.